five-minute recess and to return for the third case on the 9 o'clock docket.
Thank you. Please be seated. Court will now call Texas Mutual Insurance Company versus LaHonda Baker.
May it please the court, Mr. Plasek will argue for appellant, Mr. Randall Johnson will argue for appellee.
Mr. Plasek.
May it please the court, counsel. Statutory systems such as workers' compensation, where the rights and the obligations of the parties are determined by the legislature and the regulator, the unambiguous statutes and regulations that govern this dispute say what they mean and they mean what they say. And the plain language application of those regulations and statutes require a reversal of the decision of the trial court. Texas Mutual brings this appeal of a judicial review relating to LaHonda Baker's claim for supplemental income benefits, which we'll probably call SIBs by nature constantly through this argument, and complains of three basic mistakes in the trial of this cause. First and foremost, the trial court erred in awarding attorney's fees to Ms. Baker. There's no statutory authority to support that award because Texas Mutual never disputed any finding by the commissioner of the Division of Workers' Compensation that Ms. Baker was entitled to supplemental income benefits. Secondly, the court erred in finding that Ms. Baker was entitled to supplemental income benefits for the fourth quarter because she lacked any narrative report that established her inability to work was a result of her injury, and there were other documents that showed she could, in fact, work. And finally, they erred in finding entitlement to supplemental income benefits for the seventh and eighth quarter because, having been found able to work in those quarters, Ms. Baker's failed to do a diligent search for employment each and every week of those quarters. Before I address the specifics of the dispute in front of the court, it might be helpful to just give a brief overview of what supplemental income benefits are. And supplemental income benefits are kind of the third level of income benefits available to a worker who's been injured in the course and scope of their employment. The first level is what are called temporary income benefits, which an employee gets while they're unable to work, but they can cut off after 2 years or obviously when the employee returns to work. After an employee's temporary income benefits have ended or they've reached maximum medical improvement, the employee may be eligible for an impairment rating. And if they receive an impairment rating, then they get what are called impairment income benefits. And the higher their impairment rating, the more impairment income benefits they get. When their impairment income benefits run out, in some circumstances, an employee can qualify for supplemental income benefits or SIBs. The basic prerequisites are, first, they have to have an impairment of at least 15%, and that's not an issue in this case. Ms. Baker's impairment rating was 17%. But they also have to be earning less than 80% of their pre-injury average weekly wage as a direct result of the compensable injury, and they have to make a good faith effort during each SIBS qualifying period, and SIBS are calculated quarterly, so the qualifying period is a quarter. They have to make a good faith effort during each qualifying period to get employment commensurate with their ability to work. And the Division of Workers' Compensation has defined what that means. If they say, I have no ability to work at all, I have total inability to work, then the worker is required to provide documented medical evidence in the form of a narrative report that establishes that they don't have any ability to return to work as a direct result of their compensable injury. And there must be no other records that show an ability to work. If there is some ability to work, then there are several ways by which they can qualify for supplemental income benefits. But the only one at issue in this case is if they are not currently employed but have the ability to work, they must make a good faith job search, which the commission defines, and they have to document their efforts, but they have to search for work every week of the qualifying period. So that's sort of the background of what supplemental income benefits are and the broad look at how you get them. The specifics, though, are where Ms. Baker's claims fails. But I want to turn first to the attorney's fee question because, to my mind, that is the clearest and most egregious error at the trial court level. obviously, the default rule is that parties bear their own fees, bear their own costs in litigation. And certainly the legislature has created certain exceptions in certain arenas where you can shift the fees based on the outcome of the case in the trial court. And in the workers' compensation system, and with respect specifically to supplemental income benefits, the statute that applies is Texas Labor Code 408.147C. And what that statute provides is that if an insurance carrier disputes the commissioner's determination that an employee is entitled to supplemental income benefits or the amount of those benefits, and the employee prevails on any disputed issue, then the insurance carrier is liable for their reasonable and necessary attorney's fees occasioned by the result as a result of the insurance carrier's dispute. Now, this provision is explicit and it's unambiguous, and it has a very specific requirement that there has to be a commissioner's determination that the employee is entitled to supplemental income benefits that is being disputed. In this area, Ms. Baker's claim fails because the commissioner, the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission, never made a finding that she was entitled to supplemental income benefits. To the contrary, at every single administrative level, she was found not to be eligible for the benefits. And there are three different levels that that's looked at. There's initial SIBS eligibility letter that goes out. For all eight quarters at issue, they found her not eligible for the benefits. There's a contested case hearing in front of the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission. For all eight quarters, they found her not eligible for the benefits. And then finally, the appeals panel of the Texas Workers' Compensation Commission can review it, and they didn't reverse. They didn't say, well, you get this quarter or that quarter. There has never been any finding at the commission level that Ms. Baker was entitled to supplemental income benefits. And that being the case, the fee-shifting provision simply doesn't apply to her claim. In the case of Travelers Indemnity v. Mayfield, the Texas Supreme Court noted that the authorization of attorney's fees in civil cases may not be inferred. It has to be provided in the express terms of the statute. And the express terms of these statutes, of this statute, predicates the recovery and the shifting of attorney's fees on an initial commissioner's determination of eligibility for those benefits. That didn't occur here. Now, Ms. Baker's certainly not the only worker who's ever tried to shoehorn herself into attorney's fees under that provision, but the courts have consistently rejected that when it goes afoul of the plain language of the statute. The Travelers Indemnity case from the Texas Supreme Court involved a court ordering the carrier to pay an appointed attorney, and the court said, look, this statute has a specific provision, a commission determination of the entitlement of supplemental income benefits. If that's not here, we can't apply this exception to the rule that you bear your own costs.
How about our Montana decision?
And your Montana decision comes exactly to the same conclusion. And if, really? If you look...
I'm looking on page 603.
Right, on page 603, and then later on 604, where it actually states the holding, we determine that the plain language of the statute authorizes an award of attorney's fees in any case where the commission initially awards SIBs, and the carrier later disputes that award. Well, that hasn't happened here. There was no initial award of SIBs at the commission level.
Well, it also says the employee can receive attorney's fees even if the employee does not prevail until the district court level or beyond.
Well, actually what the court said, that court there is quoting an appeals panel decision
mm-hmm.
that said that.
Right.
And then the court noted that the appeals panel developed that and has in fact limited that to if the insurance carrier disputes a commission determination. If that, you'll find that a couple of paragraphs later. It says the appeals panel thus has interpreted 408.147C to authorize attorney's fees if the carrier ever disputes any commission determination that the employee is entitled to SIBs. And that's the rule that the court actually adopted on page 604. So you're right, that language is in there, but it's in the discussion of appeals panel decision that's since been developed, and the court has adopted the rule developed in the second discussion in the Montana case. Because the plain language does require a commission determination. It doesn't say commission or court. The legislature clearly knows the difference between an administrative agency and a district court. And we have to presume when they use the word commission, they mean commission. They don't mean commission or court. They're perfectly capable of providing for an award for a court victory if they want to do that. But that's not the way the statute's been written. So I believe Montana actually supports the position that we've put forth here, which is that there has to be some initial determination. And Montana stretches that statute as far as you can go. It says any determination. It gives the full benefit of doubt to the claimant, but you still have to have that initial determination for at least one quarter at least one level of the commission, and you just don't have that here. I want to move quickly to the fourth quarter issue. In the fourth quarter, the jury found that that Ms. Baker had a total inability to work. And the rules of the commission to support a finding of total inability to work require a narrative report that, quote, specifically explains how the injury caused a total inability to work. It's our contention that's absent in the record. There is no such narrative report. There's at best a conglomeration of records, but none of which specifically explain how the injury caused a total inability to work. The closest that she has is an April 23rd, 2005 letter from her doctor, Dr. Osborne, where he says, it's my opinion that she is completely and permanently disabled as a result of a low back injury. Well, that sounds pretty good until you realize that her compensable injury was her neck and her shoulder and her carpal tunnel, but not her low back. So she does have documents that she can't work, but they don't explain how that relates to the compensable injury. And in my review of the record, I haven't found any document for the fourth that covers the fourth quarter that says she can't work because of a neck injury. She can't work because of a shoulder injury. She can't work because of a hand injury. And that's what's required to meet that standard. I would further point out that there are other records that show an ability to work, which is the second prong of eligibility for a total inability to work. The designated doctor appointed by the commission said on January 4th of 2003, you can return to work without restriction. Dr. Kennedy, who evaluated her work capacity in June of 2005, specifically opined that during the fourth quarter period she could have been working. That's defendants exhibits 6, 16, and 17. And in fact, that ability to work is belied by her own application for fourth quarter SIBS, where she says that no doctor has ever documented a total inability to work. So I don't think there's any surprise, I don't think there's any shock that she was able to work. Finally, to move to the seventh and eighth quarter of supplemental income benefits, in the seventh and eighth quarter, the jury found that she did have an ability to work. And so that invokes Texas Administrative Code 130.102E. And the requirements of 130.102E are that if the worker has an ability to work during the qualifying period, they must look for employment commensurate with their ability to work every week of the qualifying period and document their job search efforts. The only evidence in this case demonstrates that during the seventh quarter, from a period of December 12th of 2004 to January 5th of 2005, a three-week period, no job search efforts. She admitted that in her testimony. And in the eighth period, from March 15th, 2005 to March 21st, 2005, a period just over 1 week, no job search efforts. That being the case, there's a complete absence of a vital fact to support the finding that she made a good faith search for work, because there are complete weeks that are missing in her documentation, missing in her testimony. And you have to have evidence every single week to meet that. And the Texas Court of Appeals out of Amarillo in Teague versus Insurance Company of Pennsylvania says every week means every week. There's not a sick child exception. There's not a Christmas vacation exception. If you're going to come to the commission and ask for SIBS and you have some ability to work, you must search for work every week of the qualifying period. We believe that the statutory language on attorney's fees does not support the award of the court because there was no initial determination at the commission level that she had an entitlement to SIBs. We believe that the evidence, factually and legally, is insufficient to support the fourth quarter award and the seventh and eighth quarter awards, and we would ask the court to reverse the decision of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Plasek. Mr. Johnson?
Please, court, counsel, Chief Justice. My name is Randy Johnson, and I'm here today with Leslie Casabon. It was our privilege to represent Ms. Baker in the trial court below and again here in this court. Bottom line is that Texas Mutual has not shown that the trial judge abused his discretion in awarding attorney's fees. There is a statute which this court has recognized in an opinion authored by yourself, Chief Justice Casey, that 408.147 does authorize an award of attorney's fees in a case like this. And I think it's important when we look at this statute to keep in mind what the purpose and intent of the workers' compensation law is. The purpose is to provide benefits to injured workers, to protect injured workers. And this particular statute, this SIB statute, is the only exception. Well, strike that. There's two exceptions to the general rule regarding attorney's fees under the Workers' Compensation Act. In the general course of business, attorney's fees are only payable out of the income benefits that are paid to the claimant, and they're subject to a 25% cap. There are only two exceptions to that. One is where the claimant is the defendant in a judicial review proceeding, for obvious reasons. The legislature decided that they did not want carriers filing frivolous appeals and that to the judicial review stage and in a situation where claimants would not be able to get attorneys, so they passed that statute and that change in the act to prohibit that sort of practice from occurring. That's a special case. The only other situation under the Workers' Compensation Act where you have an exception to the general rule for attorney's fees is in the SIBS chapter, which is subchapter H, in particular 408.147, the statute that's in play in this case. And why is that? And that's because SIBS is the only benefit that's payable under the Workers' Compensation Act that must be qualified for on a quarterly basis. It's not like, do you have a compensable injury or do you not? Do you have disability? If so, for what period of time? You may only have that come up once in a case. But with SIBS, it comes up every quarter. And every quarter, a claimant has to re-qualify. And what the legislature did here was they passed this statute, which would allow for attorney's fees to be handled differently in a SIBS case. Why? To prevent carriers from doing repetitious and vexatious disputes of SIBS benefits and requiring the claimant to go to multiple CCHs, contested case hearings, multiple benefit review conferences. And what they said is when a carrier disputes SIBS and loses, you will then have to pay the benefits separate and apart from the attorney's fees, separate and apart from the benefits. And I think it's very important that when we look at this statute that we do not lose sight of the title of this statute. The statute is titled Contest of Supplemental Income Benefits by Insurance Carrier Attorney's Fees. What TMI would have you do is say that that's only triggered by some action by the commission, or the division in this case, that the commission has to take some action before you would ever have this statute come into play. That's not how it's titled, though. It says if there's a contest by a carrier, which is what we have here, then the attorney's fees will be paid separate and apart should they lose on that. And clearly, they've disputed this or we wouldn't be here. Originally, they tried to say, well, we didn't ever dispute SIBS. That was the commission. They issued a notice of non-entitlement. But you'll see in the record there is evidence that they did dispute the second quarter on. They've vigorously disputed it at all levels, and including the trial court. So it's beyond dispute that they have contested Ms. Baker's rights to SIBS. And I believe, Justice McCoy, as you point out, I think the salient language from the Montana case is, in fact, that language on page 603, where it says, the appeals panel thus recognized that if the carrier challenges the award of SIBS at any time, the employee can receive attorney's fees even if the employee does not prevail until a district court level or beyond. That is a fair,
Your interpretation, though, of this statute would require that we ignore the words, the commissioner's determination. I mean, I think you would have an argument if the statute actually read, if an insurance carrier disputes that an employee is entitled to supplemental income benefits. I mean, that's what you're saying, that the way the statute reads. But if that's so, then what was the purpose of the legislature putting in the words, the commissioner's determination?
First of all, I want to make one distinction here, because I think it's important to keep in mind that, again, we look at the title of this. We also look at 408.141, which talks about award of supplemental income benefits, and it talks about an award of supplemental income benefits, whether by a commissioner or a court. And I would submit to you that this is not the only place where it might not be clear, but the legislature has, in many instances, used commissioner or commission and court synonymously. Also, I want to point out, and I'm not sure how to resolve this here. This statute was changed right about the time that this all took place. The notice of non-entitlement that came out in this case was in January of 05. The BRC was in August of 05. Effective September 1 of 05, this statute was changed. It used to say a commission determination. It was changed in September of 05 to say a commissioner's determination. And the reason I bring this up is because I think it does answer your question. If we were to interpret that literally the way it's worded right now, the commissioner's determination, this statute would never apply, because the commissioner does not make a determination. When the determinations came out before, it would be signed sincerely Texas Workers' Compensation Commission. Now it's sincerely Division of Workers' Compensation, Texas Department of Insurance. So you would never, ever have this triggered if you read that literally, that there must be a commissioner determination of entitlement. That's the first thing. It renders the statute meaningless. So I think when you look at that and that ambiguity is created, you have to go back to the title, Contest of Supplemental Income Benefits by Insurance Carrier. The other thing is I think you need to look at where it says the commissioner's determination that an employee is entitled. You had a determination here. You had a determination of non-entitlement. And a determination of non-entitlement is essentially the same as a determination of entitlement. They have made a determination one way or the other as to whether you are or not entitled. I think you can interpret it that way, and it squares it with the wording, as well as when you view it in light of the way it's titled and the way it's put into the Act. It's under the supplemental income benefits provisions in the Act. Those fees are part of the benefits. Those fees are awardable, whether it's a court or a commission, a determination that's been disputed. And more importantly, given the ambiguity that's created between the title and the way that's worded, you've got the commission's own interpretation of it. And the commission has interpreted this to mean that you can have an award of fees without there being an initial determination, which is the way they originally did it. It doesn't say initial determination. And think of two hypotheticals. If you interpret it strictly by that wording, I think it renders the statute constitutionally infirm, because it's clearly a deprivation of equal protection to have a statute that says, if we have identical situations, we have a claimant on the one hand, we have a situation where there's been a determination of non-entitlement. The carrier doesn't pay. The claimant goes to a contested case hearing, loses, goes to the appeals panel, loses, goes to judicial review, wins. Under a strict interpretation of this statute, as urged by TMI, the claimant would receive his benefits but subtract from that 25% for his attorney's fees, up to 25%. So he's received 75% of what he should have gotten had the commission not made the incorrect determination initially. Let's take the second situation, where the only difference is they make a determination of entitlement. Now he's getting 100% of his fees, 100% of his SIBs when he wins, because he's now going to get that, plus he's going to get these fees over and above. Again, the only difference is that in one case the commission got it wrong, in the other case they got it right, but we still had a dispute. How is that fair to a claimant, triggering that on what happens, what the commission determines, instead of on the dispute itself? The intent was to keep the carriers from going out and having multiple disputes of these claims. If they lose, then they're going to be punished. So it makes no sense to trigger it on the commission whether they made a determination of entitlement or non-entitlement. What if we take that one step further and there's a determination of non-entitlement? The carrier doesn't pay the first quarter but pays the second and third quarters. And then they say, no, we're not going to pay any more quarters after this. And the claimant takes that and loses at the CCH and at the appeals panel but wins on judicial review. Why would it be fair for him to not be paid his full SIBs just because the commission had made an erroneous determination to begin with? And I can hear the carrier saying, well, it's not fair to have the carrier foot the bill for this either. But that's the way it is in workers' comp. They foot the bill for everything. They pay for designated doctor exams that are asked for by the commission and not them. They pay for the medical, whether it's the claimant's medical or their RME doctors that they choose. That's the way the system works. And in this particular case, that's the only way that this statute makes sense, is to have it where any time the carrier disputes or contests SIBs and then loses, whether it be at the commission level or later at the district court level, they should have to pay those attorney's fees separate. As far as the narrative report requirement, that's probably one of the easiest things to deal with this in this case. What the carrier has to show here is that there's either, if they want their legal sufficiency challenges, there's no evidence to support the jury's finding regarding the fourth quarter, or that it's against the great weight and preponderance of the other evidence. And quite simply, if you look at the exhibits that we have, Exhibit D, Carrier's D on D7, that's the contested case hearing officer's decision order, he interprets the law correctly when he says, his letters, meaning the treating doctor's letters and medical notes, would qualify as a narrative report from a doctor which specifically explains how the injury causes a total inability to work. That contested case hearing officer's decision and order was in evidence. It's not objected to here today as being improperly in evidence. It's something that the law says that the jury should consider or should be informed of what's decided. That's evidence, that's at least some evidence to show that there was a compliance with the narrative report requirement. In addition, if you look at our brief on pages 37 and 38, we point out some of the specific medical reports which comply with the narrative report requirement. Certainly the evidence is sufficient to support that. As far as the no ability to work, we deal with this a lot. The carriers interpret that provision. It's Rule 130.102D4, the no ability way of showing good faith effort is that if you have no ability to work and your doctor provides a narrative report and there are no other records which show you had an ability to work. And what we have here is we've got Texas Mutual saying, well, these records state there's an ability to work, therefore you lose. But that's not the way it works. They must show, and that's a fact issue. And we've cited the appeals panel decisions which have held that that's a fact issue. That is something for the jury to determine. Did these records that have been relied on by the carrier, all but one of which are outside of our qualifying period, did these records show an ability to work? Clearly, the jury didn't feel they showed that. It's not up to this court to substitute their opinion for that. There is evidence to support that. It's in the record. And so whether there's contrary evidence, there is evidence there. So that should be affirmed. And finally, on the seventh and eighth compensable quarters, again, we agree. The statutes say what they mean, and they mean what they say. They have taken a provision, Rule 130.102D5, and they have looked at that, and they focused on must show that they looked for work every week during the filing period. What they leave out is the part of the statute which says shall look for employment commensurate with his or her ability to work every week. Is able to work, shall look for employment commensurate with his or her ability every week. Teague is not inconsistent with that. If you look at Teague, it is in no way inconsistent with the hybrid theory approach that we've cited in our brief. What you have here is a situation where the jury could have and did properly in this case conclude that she made a good faith effort to look during those weeks in which she was able to work and didn't in those weeks when she wasn't. And they're going to come back and they're going to point out the other jury findings saying no ability to work. If you read that, that finding does not imply or infer that the jury determined she had no ability to work every week during the qualifying period. It is not an inconsistent finding with the subsequent finding that she made a good faith effort under the definitions that were provided to the jury and which specifically say, looks for work every week commensurate with her ability to work. The appeals panel decision say if you have weeks during a qualifying period where you have no ability to work, then you don't have to look during those weeks. Teague deals with the situation where they're saying we should be excused from looking in a particular week because of some extrinsic circumstance, like I had a death in the family and I needed to go, I couldn't be looking for work that week, or I had to go to my daughter's wedding that week and we were out of town and I couldn't look for work that week. That's not what we have here. For those reasons, we ask that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Placek.
Briefly, Judge, the standard of review on the attorney's fees is not abuse of discretion, as counsel for Appley suggests. It is a de novo review of the application of the law. What I've heard on rebuttal on the attorney's fees is that entitlement means non-entitlement, commissioner means court, and basically the direct opposite of a plain language approach. The plain language of the statute does not support the award of attorney's fees here. And the very same policy reasons that counsel suggests apply equally in the context of the claimant. When the commissioner at every single level rejects the application for supplemental income benefits, is there a salutary purpose in taxing the carrier with the cost if they proceed and go forward with a judicial review? In fact, if you look
only at- if they win. Which says that the commission was wrong.
Right, the commission was wrong, not the carrier. If you look at how the commission and the legislature handles other judicial reviews, that is precisely the outcome. If the claimant loses at the commission, they don't get to recover their attorney's fees in judicial review. If the carrier loses at the commission and appeals, a prevailing claimant can recover, but that's not the situation we have here, and that's also not the plain language of the statute. With respect to the hybrid theory that they suggest, I respectfully submit there's no such language in the statute. There's no cases that suggest that any such hybrid theory does exist. Again, it's the world of 1984. Every week doesn't mean every week. There were no findings of any lack of ability to work during the seventh and eighth quarters. There were no findings of medical documentation of inability to work during those quarters. The only finding was that she was able to work during those quarters, and that under the rules, that requires a good faith search every week of the qualifying period. I mean, it says every week of the qualifying period. That's all I have on that, Judge.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Placek. Mr. Johnson, case is submitted, and the panel will recess to make a panel change and return approximately 11 o'clock.